betrayed his oath to that army in which he had been brought up, had betrayed it in order to help establish this system which now betrayed its own soldiers. Why, then, was Yuri bound by his own oath to that traitorous system? When, in the spring of 1943, recruiters from the 1st Byelorussian Legions put in an appearance, some POWs signed up with them to escape starvation. Yuri went with them out of conviction, with a clear mind. But he didn't stay in the Legion for long. As the saying goes, once they've skinned you, there's no point in grieving over the wool. By this time, Yuri had given up hiding his excellent knowledge of German, and soon a certain chief, a German from near Kassel, who had been assigned to create an espionage school with an accelerated wartime output, took Yuri as his right-hand man. And that was how Yuri began the downward slide he had not foreseen. That was how things got turned around. Yuri passionately desired to free his motherland, and what did they do but shove him into training spies? The Germans had their own plans. Just where could one draw the line? Which step was the fatal one? Yuri became a lieutenant in the German army. He travelled through Germany in German uniform, spent some time in Berlin, visited Russian émigrés, and read authors like Bunin, Nabokov, Aldanov, Amfiteatrov, whose works were forbidden at home. Yuri had anticipated that in all their writing, in Bunin's, for example, the blood flowing from Russia's living wounds would pour from every page. What was wrong with them? To what did they devote their unutterably precious freedom? To the female body? To ecstasy, sunsets, the beauty of noble brows? To anecdotes going back to dusty years? They wrote as if there had been no revolution in Russia, or as if it were too complex for them to explain. They left it to young Russian people to find for themselves what was highest in life. And Yuri dashed back and forth, in a hurry to see, in a hurry to know, and meanwhile, in accordance with ancient Russian tradition, he kept drowning his confusion more and more often and more deeply in vodka. What was their spy school, really? It was, of course, not a real one. All they could be taught in 6 months was to master the parachute, the use of explosives, and the use of portable radios. The Germans put no special trust in them. In sending them across the lines, they were simply whistling in the dark. And for those dying, hopelessly abandoned Russian POWs, those schools, in Yuri's opinion, were a good way out. The men ate their fill, got new warm clothing, and in addition had their pockets stuffed with Soviet money. The students, and their teachers, acted as if all this nonsense were genuine, as if they would actually carry out spying missions in the Soviet rear, blow up the designated objectives, get back in touch with the Germans via radio, and return to the German line. But in reality, in their eyes, this school was simply a means of sidestepping death and captivity. They wanted to live, but not at the price of shooting their own compatriots at the front. Of course, our Soviet interrogators did not accept this line of reasoning. What right did they have to want to live at a time when privileged families in the Soviet rear lived well without collaborating? No one ever thought of considering that these boys had refused to take up German arms against their own people. For playing spies, they were nailed with the very worst and most serious charges of all, Article 58.6, plus sabotage with intent. This meant to be held until dead. The Germans sent them across the front lines, and from then on their free choice depended on their own morality and conscience. They all threw away their TNT and radio apparatus immediately. The only point on which they differed was whether to surrender to the authorities immediately, like the snub-nosed spy I had encountered at Army Counterintelligence Headquarters, or whether to get drunk first and have some fun squandering all that free money. None of them ever recrossed the front lines to the Germans. Suddenly, as the new year of 1945 approached, one smart fellow did return, and reported he had carried out his assignment. Just go and check on it. He created a sensation. The chief hadn't the slightest doubt that Smirsch had sent him back and decided to shoot him. The fate of a conscientious spy. But Yuri insisted that he be given a decoration instead, and held up as an example to the others taking the course. The returned spy invited Yuri to drink a quart of vodka with him, and crimson from drink, leaned across the table and disclosed, "Yuri Nikolaevich, the Soviet command promises you forgiveness if you will come over to us immediately." Yuri trembled, and that heart which had already grown hard, which had renounced everything, was flooded with warmth. The motherland? Accursed, unjust, but nonetheless still precious. Forgiveness? And he could go back to his own family? And walk along Kamno-Ostrovsky in Leningrad? All right, so what? We are Russians. If you will forgive us, we will return, and we will behave ourselves. Oh, how well! That year and a half since he had left the POW camp had not brought Yuri happiness. He did not repent, but he could see no future either. And when, while drinking, he encountered other such unrepentant Russians, he learned that they realized clearly that they had nothing to stand on. It wasn't real life. The Germans were twisting them to suit themselves. But now, when the Germans were obviously losing the war, Yuri had been offered an out. His chief, who liked him, confided that he had a second estate in Spain which they could head for together if the German Reich went up in smoke. But there across the table sat his drunken compatriot, coaxing him at the risk of his own life. "Yuri Nikolaevich, the Soviet command values your experience and knowledge. They want you to tell them about the organization of the German intelligence service." For 2 weeks, Yuri was torn by hesitation. But during the Soviet offensive beyond the Vistula, after he had led his school well out of the way, he ordered them to turn into a quiet Polish farm, lined them all up, and declared, "I am going over to the Soviet side. There is a free choice for everyone." And these sad sack spies, with the milk hardly dry on their lips, who just 1 hour before had pretended loyalty to the German Reich, now cried out with enthusiasm, "Hurrah! Us too!" They were shouting hurrah for their future lives at hard labor. Then the entire spy school hid until the arrival of the Soviet tanks, and then came Smirsch. Yuri saw his boys no more. They took him off by himself and gave him 10 days to describe the whole history of the school, the programs, the sabotage assignments. He really thought that they valued his experience and knowledge. They were already talking about his going home to his family. Only when he arrived at the Lubyanka did he realize that even in Salamanca he would have been closer to his native neighbor. He could now await being shot, or in any case a sentence of certainly not less than 20 years. So immutably does a human being surrender to the mist of the motherland. Just as a tooth will not stop aching until the nerve is killed, so is it with us. We shall probably not stop responding to the call of the motherland until we swallow arsenic. The lotus eaters in the Odyssey knew of a certain lotus for that purpose. In all, Yuri spent 3 weeks in our cell. I argued with him during all those weeks. I said that our revolution was magnificent and just, that only its 1929 distortion was terrible. He looked at me regretfully, compressing his nervous lips. Before trying our hands at revolution, we should have exterminated the bedbugs in this country. Sometimes, oddly, he and Fastenko arrived at the same conclusions, approaching them from such different beginnings. I said there had been a long period in which the people in charge of everything important in our country had been people of unimpeachably lofty intentions and totally dedicated. He said that from the very beginning they were all cut from the same cloth as Stalin. We agreed that Stalin was a gangster. I praised Gorky to the skies. What a smart man he had been, how correct his point of view. What a great artist he was. And Yuri parried. He was an insignificant, terribly boring personality. He invented himself. He invented his heroes. And his books were fabrications from beginning to end. Lev Tolstoy, he was the king of our literature. As a result of these daily arguments, vehement because of our youth, he and I were never able to become really close or to discern and accept in each other more than we rejected. They took him out of our cell, and since then, no matter how often I have inquired, I have found no one who was imprisoned with him in the Butyrki, and no one who encountered him in a transit prison. Even the rank-and-file Vlasov men have all disappeared without a trace, under the earth most likely, and even now some of them do not have the documents they need in order to leave the northern wastes. But even among them, the fate of Yuri Y. was not a rank-and-file fate. At long last, our Lubyanka lunch arrived. Long before it got to us, we could hear the cheery clatter in the corridor. And then, as in a restaurant, they brought in a tray with two aluminum plates, not bowls, for each prisoner. One plate held a ladle full of soup, and the other a ladle full of the thinnest kind of thin gruel, with no fat in it. In his first excitement, a prisoner couldn't get anything down his throat. There were those who didn't touch their bread for several days, who didn't know where to put it. But gradually one's appetite returned, and then a chronically famished state ensued that became almost uncontrollable. Then, if one managed to get it under control, one's stomach shrank and adapted itself to inadequate food, at which point the meager Lubyanka fare became just right. One needed to have self-control to achieve this, and also needed to stop looking around to see who might be eating something extra. All those extremely dangerous prison conversations about food had to be outlawed, and one had to try to lift oneself, as far as possible, into higher spheres. At the Lubyanka, this was made easier by our being permitted 2 hours of rest after lunch, something else that was astonishingly resort-like. We lay down, our backs to the peephole, set up open books for appearance's sake, and dozed off. Sleep was forbidden, strictly speaking, and the guards could see that the pages of the books hadn't been turned for a long time. But ordinarily, they did not knock during this period. The explanation for this humanitarianism was that whoever wasn't resting during these hours was undergoing interrogation. Thus, for those who were stubborn, who had not signed the depositions, the contrast was unmistakable. They returned to the cell at the very end of the rest period. And sleep was the very best thing for hunger and anguish. One's organism cooled off, and the brain stopped recapitulating one's mistakes over and over again. Then they brought in dinner, another ladle of gruel. Life was setting all its gifts before you. After that, you were not going to get anything to eat in the 5 or 6 hours before bedtime, but that was not so terrible. It was easy to get used to not eating in the evenings. That has long been known in military medicine, and in reserve regiments they don't have anything to eat in the evening. Then came the time for the evening visit to the toilet, for which, in all likelihood, you had waited all a tremble all day. How relieved, how eased the whole world suddenly became. How the great questions all simplified themselves at the same instant. Did you feel it? Oh, the weightless Lubyanka evenings. Only weightless, incidentally, if you were not awaiting a night interrogation. A weightless body just sufficiently satisfied by soup, so that the soul did not feel oppressed by it. What light, free thoughts. It was as if we had been lifted up to the heights of Sinai, and there the truth manifested itself to us from out the fire. Was it not of this that Pushkin dreamed, I want to live, to think, and suffer? And there we suffered, and we thought, and there was nothing else in our lives. How easy it turned out to be to attain that ideal. Some evenings I would get involved in arguments, withdrawing from a chess game with Susie or from a book. Again, I would have the sharpest quarrels with Yuri, because the questions were all explosive ones. For example, the question of the outcome of the war. The jailer, without any word or change of expression, would come in and pull down the dark blue blackout blind on the window. And then, out there on the other side of the blind, evening Moscow would begin to send up salutes. And just as we could not see the salutes lighting up the heavens, we were unable to see the map of Europe. Yet we tried to picture it in all its details, and to guess which cities had been taken. Yuri was especially tormented by those salutes, appealing to fate to correct his own mistakes. He assured us that the war was by no means finished, and that the Red Army and the Anglo-American forces would now go for each other's throats, that the real war would really begin now. The others in the cell took a greedy interest in this prediction. How would such a conflict end? Yuri claimed it would end with the easy destruction of the Red Army. Would this result in our liberation or our execution? I objected to this, and we got into heated arguments. It was his contention that our army was worn down, bled white, poorly supplied, and most importantly, that it would not fight with its usual determination against the Allies. I, however, insisted, on the basis of the units I had been familiar with, that the army was not so much worn down as experienced, that it had now become both strong and mean, and that in such an event it would crush the Allies even more thoroughly than it had the Germans. "Never!" cried Yuri in a half-whisper. "And what about the Ardennes?" I answered in a half-whisper. Pastenko interrupted us, ridiculing us both, informing us that we did not understand the West and that no one, now or ever, could compel the Allied armies to fight against us. However, in the evening we didn't want to argue so much as to hear something interesting that might bring us closer together, and to talk in a spirit of fellowship. One favourite subject of conversation was prison traditions, how it used to be in prison. We had Pastenko and were therefore able to hear these stories at first hand. What dismayed us most of all was to learn that it had previously been an honour to be a political prisoner, and that it was not only their relatives who stuck by them and refused to renounce them, but that girls who had never even met them came to visit them, pretending for that purpose to be their fiancés. And what about the once universal tradition of gifts for the prisoners on holidays? No one in Russia ever broke the Lenten fast without first taking gifts for unknown prisoners to the common prison kitchen. They brought in Christmas hams, tarts, and kulichi, the special Russian Easter cakes. One poor old lady even used to bring a dozen coloured Easter eggs. It made her feel better. And where had all that Russian generosity gone? It had been replaced by political consciousness. That was how cruelly and implacably they had terrified our people and cured them of taking thought for and caring for those who were suffering. Today it would seem silly to do such a thing. If it was proposed today that some institution organize a pre-holiday collection of gifts for prisoners in the local prison, it would be virtually considered an anti-Soviet revolt. That's how far we have gone along the road to being brutalized. And what about those holiday gifts? Were they only a matter of tasty food? More importantly, those gifts gave the prisoners the warm feeling that people in freedom were thinking about them and were concerned for them. Pastenko told us that even in the Soviet period, a political Red Cross had existed. We found this difficult to imagine. It wasn't that we thought he was telling us an untruth. Somehow we just couldn't picture such a thing. He told us that Y.P. Peshkova, taking advantage of her personal immunity, had travelled abroad, collected money there, you'd not collect much here, and then seen to it that foodstuffs were bought in Russia for political prisoners who had no relatives. For all political prisoners? And he explained at this point that the KRs, the so-called counter-revolutionaries, engineers and priests, for example, weren't included, but only members of former political parties. Well, why didn't you say so right away? Yes, and then for the most part the political Red Cross, except Peshkova, was itself liquidated and its staff imprisoned. It was also very pleasant, on those evenings when one wasn't expecting interrogation, to talk about getting out of prison. Yes, they said there had been astonishing instances when they did release someone. One day they took Z-blank-V from our cell, with his things, perhaps to free him. But his interrogation could not have been completed so swiftly. 10 days later he returned. They had dragged him off to Lefortovo. When he got there, he had evidently begun to sign things very quickly. So they brought him back to us. Now, if they should just release you, we would say to a fellow prisoner, since your case, after all, isn't very serious, as you yourself say, then you must promise to go see my wife, and, to show you've done it, tell her, let's say, to put 2 apples in my next parcel. But there aren't any apples anywhere right now, so tell her to put in 3 bagels. But then there mightn't be any bagels in Moscow either. So, all right, it will just have to be 4 potatoes. That's how the discussion went, and then they actually did take N off, with his things, and M got 4 potatoes in his next parcel. Truly astonishing. It was more than a coincidence. So they had really let him go. And his case was much more serious than mine. So maybe soon. However, what really happened was that M's wife bought 5 potatoes, but one of them got crushed in her bag, and M was in the hold of a ship en route to the Kolyma. And so it went. We talked about all kinds of things and recalled something amusing, and it was all very jolly and delightful to be among interesting people who were so different from those you used to spend your life with, and who came from outside your own circle of experience. Meanwhile, the silent evening check-up had come and gone, and they had taken eyeglasses away, and the light bulb had blinked 3 times. That meant that bedtime would be in 5 minutes. Quick, quick, grab a blanket. Just as you never knew at the front when a hail of shells would begin to fall all around you, here you didn't know which would be your fateful interrogation night. And we would lie down with one arm on top of the blanket and try to expel the whirlwind of thought from our heads. Go to sleep. And at a certain moment on an April evening, soon after we had seen Yuri off, the lock rattled. Hearts tightened. For whom had they come? Now the jailer would whisper, "Name with S, name with Z." But the guard did not whisper anything. The door closed. We raised our heads. There was a newcomer at the door, on the thin side, young, in a cheap blue suit and a dark blue cap. He had nothing with him. He looked around in a state of confusion. "What's the cell number?" he asked in alarm. 53. He shuddered a bit. "Are you from Freedom?" we asked. "No." He shook his head in a painful sort of way. "When were you arrested?"
"Yesterday morning."
We roared. He had a very gentle, innocent sort of face, and his eyebrows were nearly white. "What for?" It was an unfair question. One could not really expect an answer.
"Oh, I don't know. Nothing much."
That was how they all replied. Everyone here was imprisoned because of nothing much. And to the newly arrested prisoner, his own case always seemed especially nothing much. "But anyway, what was it?"
"Well, you see, I wrote a proclamation to the Russian people."
"What?" None of us had ever run into that sort of nothing much.
"Are they going to shoot me?"
His face grew longer. He kept pulling at the visor of the cap he had still not taken off. "Well, no, probably not," we reassured him. "They don't shoot anyone nowadays. They give out tenors every time the clock strikes."
"Are you a worker or a white-collar employee?"
asked the Social Democrat, true to his class principles.
"A worker."
Fastenko reached out a hand to him and triumphantly proclaimed to me, "You see, Alexander Isayevich, that's the mood of the working class." He turned away to go to sleep, assuming that there was nowhere else to go from there, and nothing else to listen to. But he was wrong.
"What do you mean, a proclamation? Just like that, without any reason? In whose name was it issued?"
"In my own."
"And who are you?"
The newcomer smiled with embarrassment.
"The Emperor, Mikhail."
An electric shock ran through us all. Once again, we raised ourselves on our cots and looked at him. No, his shy, thin face was not in the least like the face of Mikhail Romanov. And then his age, too.
"Tomorrow, tomorrow, time to sleep now," said Susie sternly.
We went to sleep, confident that the 2 hours before the morning bread ration were not going to be boring. They brought in a cot and bedding for the Emperor, and he lay down quietly next to the latrine bucket. In 1916, a portly stranger, an elderly man with a light brown beard, entered the home of the Moscow locomotive engineer Belov and said to the engineer's pious wife,
"Pelageya, you have a year-old son. Take good care of him for the Lord. The hour will come, and I will come to you again."
Then he left. Pelageya did not have the faintest idea who this man was, but he had spoken so clearly and authoritatively that her mother's heart accepted his word as law. And she cared for her child like the apple of her eye. Victor grew up to be quiet, obedient, and pious, and he often saw visions of the angels and the Holy Virgin. But as he grew up, these visions became less frequent. The elderly man did not come again. Victor learned to be a chauffeur, and in 1936 he was taken into the army and sent off to Birobidzhan, where he was stationed in an auto transport company. He was not at all overly familiar or cheeky, and perhaps it was his quiet demeanor and modesty, so untypical of a chauffeur, which attracted a civilian girl employee. But the commander of his platoon was after the same girl and found himself out in the cold because of Victor. At this time, Marshal Blücher came to their area for maneuvers, and his personal chauffeur fell seriously ill. Blücher ordered the commander of the motor company to send him the best driver in the company. The company commander summoned the platoon commander, who immediately latched onto the idea of dumping his rival, Belov. That's the way it often is in the army. The person who deserves promotion doesn't get it, and the person they want to get rid of does. In addition, Belov was sober, a hard worker, and reliable. He wouldn't let them down. Blücher liked Belov, so Belov stayed with him. Soon Blücher was summoned to Moscow on a plausible pretext. This was how they separated the marshal from his power base in the Far East before arresting him. He had brought his own chauffeur, Belov, to Moscow with him. Having lost his boss, Belov then landed in the Kremlin garage and began chauffeuring, sometimes for Mikhailov of the Komsomol, sometimes for Lozovsky or somebody else in the leadership, and finally for Khrushchev. He had a close view of things, and he told us a lot, too, about the feasts, the morals, the security precautions. As a representative of the rank-and-file Moscow proletariat, he was also present at the trial of Bukharin in the House of the Unions. Of all those for whom he worked, he spoke well only of Khrushchev. Only in Khrushchev's home was the chauffeur seated at the family table, instead of being put in the kitchen. Only there, in those years, did he find the simplicity of the working man's life preserved. Khrushchev, who enjoyed life hugely, also became attached to Viktor Alexeyevich, and in 1938, when he left for the Ukraine, he tried to get him to go along. "I would have stayed with Khrushchev forever," said Viktor Alexeyevich, but for some reason he felt he should remain in Moscow. For a while, in 1941, before the beginning of the war, he was not employed in the government garage, and having no one to protect him, he was taken into military service. But because his health was poor, he was not sent to the front, but to a labor battalion. First they went on foot to Inza, to dig trenches and build roads there. After his secure and prosperous life of the previous few years, he found it painful to have his nose shoved in the dirt. He drank a full draught of grief and poverty there, and on every side he saw not only that people had not begun to live better before the war, but that they were deeply impoverished. Just barely surviving himself, and released from the service because of illness, he returned to Moscow and again managed to get himself a job as chauffeur for Shcherbakov, and after that for Sedin, People's Commissar of Petroleum. He used to describe how the obese Shcherbakov hated to see people around when he arrived at his inform bureau, so they temporarily removed all those who were working in the offices he had to walk through. Grunting because of his fat, he would lean down and pull back a corner of the carpet, and the whole inform bureau caught it, if he found any dust there. But Sedin embezzled funds to the tune of 35 million, and was quietly removed. And Belov was once again out of a job, driving for the leaders. He became a chauffeur at an automobile depot, and in his spare time he used to moonlight with his car on the road to Krasnaya Pakhra. But his thoughts were already centred elsewhere. In 1943 he had been visiting his mother. She was doing the laundry, and had gone out to the hydrant with her pails. The door opened, and a portly stranger, an old man with a white beard, entered the house. He crossed himself at the icon there, looked sternly at Belov, and said to him, "Hail, Mikhail! God gives you his blessing." Belov replied, "My name is Victor." "But," the old man continued, "you are destined to become Mikhail, the Emperor of Holy Russia." Just then Victor's mother returned, and half collapsed in fright, spilling her pails. It was the very same old man who had come to her 27 years before. He had turned white in the meantime, but it was he. "God bless you, Pelageya, you have preserved your son," said the old man. And he took the future emperor aside, like a patriarch preparing to enthrone him, and announced to the astonished young man that in 1953 there would be a change in rule, and that he would become emperor of all Russia. The prophetic old man made only one mistake. He confused the chauffeur with his former employer. That is why the number of our cell, 53, shocked him so. To this end, the old man told him, he was to begin to gather his forces in 1948. The old man didn't instruct him as to how to gather his forces. He departed, and Viktor Alexeyevich didn't get around to asking. All the peace and simplicity of his life were lost to him now. Perhaps some other individual would have recoiled from the ambitious program, but Viktor, as it happened, had rubbed shoulders with the highest of the high. He had seen all those Mikhailovs, Sherbakovs, Sedins, and he had heard a lot from other chauffeurs, too, and he had gotten it clear in his own mind that nothing in the least unusual was required, in fact just the reverse. The newly anointed Tsar, quiet, conscientious, sensitive, like Fyodor Ivanovich, the last of the line of Ryurik, felt on his brow the heavy pressure of the crown of Monomakh. All around him were the people's poverty and grief, for which he had not until now borne any responsibility. Now all this lay upon his shoulders, and he was to blame for the fact that this misery still existed. It seemed strange to him to wait until 1948, and therefore, in that very autumn of 1943, he wrote his first proclamation to the Russian people, and read it to four of his fellow workers in the garage of the People's Commissariat of Petroleum. We had surrounded Viktor Alexeyevich from early morning, and he had meekly told us all this. We had still not fathomed his childish trustfulness. We were absorbed in his unusual story, and, it was our fault, we forgot to warn him about the stoolie. In fact, we never even thought for one minute that there was anything in the naive and simple story he had told us that the interrogator didn't already know. The instant the story ended, Kramarenko began demanding to be taken either to the chief of the prison for tobacco or else to the doctor. At any rate, they summoned him quickly. And as soon as he got there, he put the finger on those four workers in the garage of the People's Commissariat of Petroleum, whose existence no one would ever have suspected. The next day, returning from his interrogation, Belov was astonished that the interrogator knew about them. And that's when it hit us. Those workers had heard the proclamation and approved it all, and no one had turned in the emperor. But he himself felt that it was too early, and he burned it. A year passed. Viktor Alexeyevich was working as a mechanic in the garage of an automobile depot. In the fall of 1944, he again wrote a proclamation and gave it to 10 people to read, chauffeurs and lathe operators. All of them approved it, and no one turned him in. It was a surprising thing, indeed, that not one person in that group of 10 had turned him in that period of ubiquitous stool pigeons. Pastenko had not been mistaken in his deductions about the mood of the working class. True, in this case the emperor had used some innocent tricks. He had thrown out hints that a strong arm inside the government was on his side, and he had promised his supporters travel assignments to rally monarchic sentiment at the grassroots. Months went by. The emperor entrusted his secret to two girls at the garage. But this time there was no misfire. These girls turned out to be ideologically sound, and Viktor Alexeyevich's heart sank. He had a premonition of disaster. On the Sunday after the annunciation, he went to the market, carrying the proclamation with him. One of his sympathizers among the old workers saw him there and said, "Viktor, you ought to burn that piece of paper for the time being. How about it?" And Viktor felt clearly that he had written it too soon and that he should burn it. "I'll burn it right now, you're right." And he started home to burn it. But right there in the market, two pleasant young men called out to him, "Viktor Alexeyevich, come along with us." And they took him to the Lubyanka in a private car. When they got him there, they had been in such a hurry and were so excited that they didn't search him in the usual way, and there was a moment when the emperor almost destroyed his proclamation in the toilet. But he decided that it would be the worse for him, that they would keep after him anyway to find out where it was, and they straight away took him in an elevator up to a general and a colonel, and the general with his own hands grabbed the proclamation from Victor's pocket. However, it took only one interrogation for the big Lubyanka to quiet down again. It turned out to be not so dangerous. 10 arrests in the garage of the auto depot and 4 in the garage of the People's Commissariat of Petroleum. The interrogation was turned over to a lieutenant colonel, who had a good laugh as he went through the proclamation. "You write here, Your Majesty, in the first spring I will instruct my Minister of Agriculture to dissolve the collective farms. But how are you going to divide up the tools and livestock? You haven't got it worked out yet. And then you also write, 'I am going to increase housing construction and house each person next to the place he works, and I am going to raise all the workers' wages.' And where are you going to find the money, Your Majesty? Are you going to have to run the money off on printing presses? You are going to abolish the state loans. And then, too,
I am going to wipe the Kremlin from the face of the earth.
But where are you going to put your own government?
What about the building of the big Lubyanka? Would you like to take a tour of inspection and look it over? Many of the younger interrogators also stopped by to make fun of the Emperor of all Russia. They saw nothing except comedy in all this. And it was not always easy for us in the cell to keep a straight face. We hope you aren't going to forget us here in cell number 53, said Z-blank-V, winking at the rest of us. Everyone laughed at him. Viktor Alexeyevich, with his white eyebrows and innocent simplicity and his calloused hands, would treat us when he received boiled potatoes from his unfortunate mother, Pelageya, without ever dividing them into yours and mine.
Come on, comrades, eat up, eat up.
He used to smile shyly. He understood perfectly well how uncontemporary and funny all this was, to be the emperor of all Russia. But what could he do if God's choice had fallen on him? They soon removed him from our cell. When they introduced me to Khrushchev in 1962, I wanted to say to him, Nikita Sergeyevich, you and I have an acquaintance in common. But I told him something else, more urgent, on behalf of former prisoners. Just before May the 1st, they took down the blackout shade on the window. The war was perceptibly coming to an end. That evening it was quieter than ever before in the Lubyanka. It was, I remember, almost like the second day of Easter, since May Day and Easter came one after the other that year. All the interrogators were out in Moscow celebrating. No one was taken to interrogation. In the silence we could hear someone across the corridor protesting. They took him from the cell and into a box. By listening, we could detect the location of all the doors. They left the door of the box open, and they kept beating him a long time. In the suspended silence, every blow on his soft and choking mouth could be heard clearly. On May the 2nd, a 30-gun salute roared out. That meant a European capital. Only two had not yet been captured, Prague and Berlin. We tried to guess which it was. On the 9th of May, they brought us our dinner at the same time as our lunch, which was done at the Lubyanka only on May the 1st and November the 7th. And that is how we guessed that the war had ended. That evening, they shot off another 30-gun salute. We then knew that there were no more capitals to be captured. And later that same evening, one more salute roared out. 40 guns, I seem to remember. And that was the end of all the ends. Above the muzzle of our window, and from all the other cells of the Lubyanka, and from all the windows of all the Moscow prisons, we too, former prisoners of war and former front-line soldiers, watched the Moscow heavens patterned with fireworks and crisscrossed by the beams of searchlights. Boris Gamarov, a young anti-tank man, already demobilized because of wounds, with an incurable wound in his lung, having been arrested with a group of students, was in prison that evening in an overcrowded Butyrki cell, where half the inmates were former POWs and front-line soldiers. He described this last salute of the war in a terse eight-stanza poem in the most ordinary language. How they were already lying down on their board bunks, covered with their overcoats. How they were awakened by the noise. How they raised their heads, squinted up at the muzzle. Oh, it's just a salute, and then lay down again, and once again covered themselves with their coats, with those same overcoats which had been in the clay of the trenches and the ashes of bonfires, and been torn to tatters by German shell fragments. That victory was not for us, and that spring was not for us either. Chapter 6. That Spring. Through the windows of the Butyrki prison every morning and evening in June 1945, we could hear the brassy notes of bands not far away, coming from either Lesnaya Street or Novoslobodskaya. They kept playing marches over and over. Behind the murky green muzzles of reinforced glass, we stood at the wide-open but impenetrable prison windows and listened. Were they military units that were marching, or were they workers cheerfully devoting their free time to marching practice? We didn't know, but the rumour had already gotten through to us that preparations were underway for a big victory parade on Red Square on June the 22nd,
the 4th anniversary of the beginning of the war. The foundation stones of a great building are destined to groan and be pressed upon. It is not for them to crown the edifice. But even the honour of being part of the foundation was denied those whose doomed heads and ribs had borne the first blows of this war and thwarted the foreigners' victory, and who were now abandoned for no good reason. Joyful sounds mean naught to the traitor. That spring of 1945 was, in our prisons, predominantly the spring of the Russian prisoners of war. They passed through the prisons of the Soviet Union in vast, dense grey shoals like ocean herring. The first trace of those schools I glimpsed was Yuri Y., but I was soon entirely surrounded by their purposeful motion, which seemed to know its own fated design. Not only war prisoners passed through those cells, a wave of those who had spent any time in Europe was rolling too. Emigres from the Civil War, the Ostovtsi, workers recruited as labourers by the Germans during World War II, Red Army officers who had been too astute and far-sighted in their conclusions, so that Stalin feared they might bring European freedom back from their European crusade, like the Decembrists 120 years before. And yet, it was the war prisoners who constituted the bulk of the wave, and among the war prisoners of various ages, most were of my own age, not precisely my age, but the twins of October, those born along with the revolution, who in 1937 had poured forth undismayed to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the revolution, and whose age group, at the beginning of the war, made up the standing army, which had been scattered in a matter of weeks. That tedious prison spring had, to the tune of the victory marches, become the spring of reckoning for my whole generation. Over our cradles, the rallying cry had resounded, "All power to the Soviets!" It was we who had reached out our sun-tanned, childish hands to clutch the pioneer's bugle, and who, in response to the pioneer challenge, "Be prepared," had saluted and answered, "We are always prepared." It was we who had smuggled weapons into Buchenwald and joined the Communist Party there. And it was we who were now in disgrace, only because we had survived. Those prisoners who had been in Buchenwald and survived were, in fact, imprisoned for that very reason in our own camps. How could you have survived an annihilation camp? Something doesn't smell right. Back when the Red Army had cut through East Prussia, I had seen downcast columns of returning war prisoners, the only people around who were grieving instead of celebrating. Even then their gloom had shocked me, though I didn't yet grasp the reason for it. I jumped down and went over to those voluntarily formed-up columns. Why were they marching in columns? Why had they lined themselves up in ranks? After all, no one had compelled them to, and the war prisoners of all other nations went home as scattered individuals. But ours wanted to return as submissively as possible. I was wearing a captain's shoulder boards, and they, plus the fact that I was moving forward, helped prevent my finding out why our POWs were so sad. But then fate turned me around and sent me in the wake of those prisoners along the same path they had taken. I had already marched with them from Army Counterintelligence Headquarters to the headquarters at the front. And when we got there, I had heard their first stories, which I didn't yet understand. And then Yuri Y. told me the whole thing. And here, beneath the domes of the brick-red Butyrki Castle, I felt that the story of these several million Russian prisoners had got me in its grip once and for all, like a pin through a specimen beetle. My own story of landing in prison seemed insignificant. I stopped regretting my torn-off shoulder boards. It was mere chance that had kept me from ending up exactly where these contemporaries of mine had ended. I came to understand that it was my duty to take upon my shoulders a share of their common burden, and to bear it to the last man until it crushed us. I now felt as if I, too, had fallen prisoner at the Soloviev crossing, in the Kharkov encirclement, in the quarries of Kerch, and hands behind my back had carried my Soviet pride behind the barbed wire of the concentration camps. That I, too, had stood for hours in the freezing cold for a ladle of cold kawa, an ersatz coffee, and had been left on the ground for dead without even reaching the kettle. That in Oflag 68, Suwalki, I had used my hands and the lid of a mess tin to dig a bell-shaped, upturned, that is, foxhole, so as not to have to spend the winter on the open field, and that a maddened prisoner had crawled up to me as I lay dying to gnaw on the still warm flesh beneath my arm, and with every new day of exacerbated, famished consciousness, lying in a barracks riddled with typhus, or at the barbed wire of the neighbouring camp for English POWs, the clear thought had penetrated my dying brain. Soviet Russia has renounced her dying children. She had needed them, proud sons of Russia, as long as they let the tanks roll over them, and it was still possible to rouse them to attack. But to feed them, once they were war prisoners, extra mouths, and extra witnesses to humiliating defeats. Sometimes we try to lie, but our tongue will not allow us to. These people were labelled traitors, but a remarkable slip of the tongue occurred on the part of the judges, prosecutors, and interrogators. And the convicted prisoners, the entire nation, and the newspapers repeated and reinforced this mistake, involuntarily letting the truth out of the bag. They intended to declare them traitors to the motherland, but they were universally referred to in speech and in writing, even in the court documents, as traitors of the motherland. You said it. They were not traitors to her. They were her traitors. It was not they, the unfortunates, who had betrayed the motherland, but their calculating motherland who had betrayed them, and not just once, but thrice. The first time she betrayed them was on the battlefield, through ineptitude, when the government, so beloved by the motherland, did everything it could to lose the war, destroyed the lines of fortifications, set up the whole air force for annihilation, dismantled the tanks and artillery, removed the effective generals, and forbade the armies to resist. Now, after 27 years, the first honest work on this subject has appeared. P.G. Grigorenko, a letter to the magazine Problems of the History of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Samizdat, 1968. And such works are going to multiply from here on out. Not all the witnesses died, and soon no one will call Stalin's government anything but a government of insanity and treason. And the war prisoners were the men whose bodies took the blow and stopped the Wehrmacht. The second time they were heartlessly betrayed by the motherland was when she abandoned them to die in captivity. And the third time they were unscrupulously betrayed was when, with motherly love, she coaxed them to return home with such phrases as, "The motherland has forgiven you. The motherland calls you," and snared them the moment they reached the frontiers. One of the biggest war criminals, Colonel General Golikov, former chief of the Red Army's intelligence administration, was put in charge of coaxing the repatriates home and swallowing them up. It would appear that during the 1,100 years of Russia's existence as a state, there have been, how many foul and terrible deeds, but among them, was there ever so multi-millioned foul a deed as this, to betray one's own soldiers and proclaim them traitors? How easily we left them out of our own accounting. He was a traitor. For shame, write him off. And our father wrote them off, even before we did. He threw the flour of Moscow's intelligentsia into the Vyazma meat grinder with Berdan single-loading rifles, vintage 1866, and only one for every five men at that. What Lev Tolstoy is going to describe that Borodino for us. And with one stupid slither of his greasy, stubby finger, the great strategist sent 120,000 of our young men, almost as many as all the Russian forces at Borodino, across the Strait of Kerch in December 1941, senselessly and exclusively for the sake of a sensational New Year's communique, and he turned them all over to the Germans without a fight. And yet, for some reason, it was not he who was the traitor, but they. How easily we let ourselves be taken in by partisan labels. How easily we agreed to regard these devoted men as traitors. In one of the Butyrki cells that spring, there was an old man, Lebedev, a metallurgist, a professor in rank, and an appearance of stalwart artisan of the last century, or maybe even the century before, from, say, the famous Demidov iron foundries. He was broad of shoulder, broad of head, wore a Pugachev-like beard, and the wide span of his hand could lift a 150-pound bucket. In the cell he wore a faded grey labourer's smock over his underwear. He was slovenly and might have been an auxiliary prison worker. Until he sat down to read, and then his habitual powerful intelligence lit up his face. The men often gathered around him. He discussed metallurgy very little, but explained to us in his kettle-drum bass voice that Stalin was exactly the same kind of dog as Ivan the Terrible. Shoot! Strangle! Don't hesitate! He explained to us also that Maxim Gorky had been a slobbering prattler, an apologist for executioners. I was very much taken with this Lebedev. It was as though the whole Russian people were embodied there before my eyes, in that one thick-set torso with that intelligent head and the arms and legs of a ploughman. He had already thought through so much. I learned from him to understand the world. And suddenly, with a chopping gesture of his huge hand, he thundered out that those charged under Article 58.1b were traitors of the motherland and must not be forgiven. And those very same 1Bs were piled up on the board bunks all around. And how hurtful to them this was. The old man was pontificating with such conviction in the name of Russia's peasantry and labour that they were abashed and found it hard to defend themselves against the attack from this new direction. I was the one to whom it fell, along with two boys charged under 5810, to defend them and to argue with the old man. But what depths of enforced ignorance were achieved by the monstrous lies of the state. Even the most broad-minded of us can embrace only that part of the truth into which our own snout has blundered. Vitkovsky writes about this on the basis of the 30s in more general terms. It was astonishing that the pseudo-wreckers, who knew perfectly well that they weren't wreckers, believed that military men and priests were being shaken up justifiably. The military men, who knew they hadn't worked for foreign intelligence services and had not sabotaged the Red Army, believed readily enough that the engineers were wreckers and that the priests deserved to be destroyed. In prison, the Soviet person reasoned in the following way. I personally am innocent, but any methods are justified in dealing with those others, the enemies. The lessons of interrogation and the cell failed to enlighten such people. Even after they themselves had been convicted, they retained the blind beliefs of their days in freedom, belief in universal conspiracies, poisonings, wreckings, espionage. How many wars Russia has been involved in? It would have been better if there had been fewer. And were there many traitors in all those wars? Had anyone observed that treason had become deeply rooted in the hearts of Russian soldiers? Then, under the most just social system in the world, came the most just war of all, and out of nowhere millions of traitors appeared, from among the simplest, lowliest elements of the population. How is this to be understood and explained? Capitalist England fought at our side against Hitler. Marx had eloquently described the poverty and suffering of the working class in that same England. Why was it that in this war only one traitor could be found among them, the businessman Lord Haw Haw? But in our country, millions. It is frightening to open one's trap about this, but might the heart of the matter not be in the political system? One of our most ancient proverbs justifies the war prisoner. The captive will cry out, but the dead man never. During the reign of Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich, nobility was granted for durance in captivity, and in all subsequent wars it was considered society's duty to exchange prisoners, to comfort one's own and to give them sustenance and aid. Every escape from captivity was glorified as the height of heroism. Throughout World War I, money was collected in Russia to aid our prisoners of war, and our nurses were permitted to go to Germany to help our prisoners, and our newspapers reminded their readers daily that our prisoners of war, our compatriots, were languishing in evil captivity. All the Western peoples behaved the same in our war. Parcels, letters, all kinds of assistance flowed freely through the neutral countries. The Western POWs did not have to lower themselves to accept ladlefuls from German soup kettles. They talked back to the German guards. Western governments gave their captured soldiers their seniority rights, their regular promotions, even their pay. The only soldier in the world who cannot surrender is the soldier of the world's one and only Red Army. That's what it says in our military statutes. The Germans would shout at us from their trenches. Ivan, plein nicht! Ivan, no prisoner. Who can picture all that means? There is war, there is death, but there is no surrender. What a discovery. What it means is, go and die, we will go on living. And if you lose your legs, yet manage to return from captivity on crutches, we will convict you. The Leningrader Ivanov, commander of a machine gun platoon in the Finnish war, was subsequently thus imprisoned in Ust-Vimalag, for example. Our soldiers alone, renounced by their motherland and degraded to nothing in the eyes of enemies and allies, had to push their way to the swine swill being doled out in the backyards of the Third Reich. Our soldiers alone had the doors shut tight to keep them from returning to their homes, although their young souls tried hard not to believe this. There was something called Article 58(1)(b), and in wartime it provided only for execution by shooting. For not wanting to die from a German bullet, the prisoner had to die from a Soviet bullet for having been a prisoner of war. Some get theirs from the enemy, and we get it from our own. Incidentally, it is very naive to say, what for? At no time have governments been moralists. They never imprisoned people and executed them for having done something. They imprisoned and executed them to keep them from doing something. They imprisoned all those POWs, of course, not for treason to the motherland, because it was absolutely clear even to a fool that only the Vlasov men could be accused of treason. They imprisoned all of them to keep them from telling their fellow villagers about Europe. What the eye doesn't see, the heart doesn't grieve for. What, then, were the courses of action open to Russian war prisoners? There was only one legally acceptable course, to lie down and let oneself be trampled to death. Every blade of grass pushes its fragile length upward in order to live. As for you, lie down and be trampled on. Even though you've been slow about it, even though you couldn't do it on the battlefield, at least die now, then you will not be prosecuted. The soldiers sleep. They spoke their word, and they are right for eternity. At every other path which, in desperation, your mind may invent is going to lead you into conflict with the law. Escape and return to the motherland, past the guards ringing the camp, across half Germany, then through Poland or the Balkans, led straight to Smersh and prison. They were asked, how did you manage to escape when others couldn't? This stinks. Come on, you rat, what assignment did they give you? Mikhail Bernatsev, Pavel Bondarenko, and many, many others. It has become the accepted thing for our literary critics to say that Sholokhov, in his immortal story Sudbar Chelofika, The Fate of a Man, spoke the bitter truth about this side of our life, and that he revealed the problem. But we must retort that in this story, which is in general very inferior, and in which the passages about the war are pale and unconvincing, since the author evidently knew nothing about the last war, and the descriptions of Germans are unconvincing cartoon clichés, only the hero's wife is successfully portrayed, because she is a pure Christian straight out of Dostoevsky. In this story about a war prisoner, the real problem of the war prisoners was hidden or distorted. 1. The author picked the least incriminating form of being taken prisoner conceivable. The soldier was captured while unconscious, so as to make him non-controversial and to bypass the whole poignancy of the problem. What if he had been conscious when he was taken prisoner, as was most often the case? What would have happened to him then? 2. The fact that the motherland had deserted us, had renounced us, had cursed us, was not presented as the war prisoner's chief problem. Sholokhov says not a word about it. But it was because of that particular factor that there was no way out. On the contrary, he identifies the presence of traitors among us as constituting the problem. But if this really was the main thing, one might then expect him to have investigated further and explained where they came from a full quarter century after a revolution that was supported by the entire people. 3. Sholokhov dreamed up a fantastic spy story escape from captivity, stretching innumerable points to avoid the obligatory, inevitable procedural step of the returned war prisoner's reception in Smersh, the identification and screening camp. Not only was Sokolov, the hero, not put behind barbed wire, as provided in the regulations, but,
and this is a real joke, he was given a month's holiday by his colonel. In other words, the freedom to carry out the assignment given him by the fascist intelligence service. So his colonel would end up in the same place as he. Escaping to the Western partisans, to the resistance forces, only postponed your full reckoning with the military tribunal. Also, it made you still more dangerous. You could have acquired a very harmful spirit through living freely among Europeans, and if you had not been afraid to escape and continue to fight, it meant you were a determined person and thus doubly dangerous in the motherland. Did you survive POW camp at the expense of your compatriots and comrades? Did you become a member of the camp Polizei, or a commandant, a helper of the Germans and of death? Stalinist law did not punish you any more severely than if you had operated with the resistance forces. It was the same article of the code and the same term. And one could guess why, too. Such a person was less dangerous. But the inert law that is inexplicably implanted in us forbade this path to all except the dregs. In addition to those four possibilities, either impossible or unacceptable, there was a fifth, to wait for German recruiters to see what they would summon you to. Sometimes, fortunately, representatives came from German rural districts to select hired men for their farmers. Sometimes they came from corporations and picked out engineers and mechanics. According to the supreme Stalinist imperative, you should have rejected that too. You should have concealed the fact that you were an engineer. You should have concealed the fact that you were a skilled worker. As an industrial designer or electrician, you could have preserved your patriotic purity only if you had stayed in the POW camp to dig in the earth, to rot, to pick through the garbage heap. In that case, for pure treason to the motherland, you could count on getting, your head raised high in pride, 10 years in prison, and 5 more muzzled. Whereas for treason to the motherland, aggravated by working for the enemy, especially in one's own profession, you got, with bowed head, the same 10 years in prison, and 5 more muzzled. And that was the jeweler's precision of a beer moth, Stalin's trademark. Now and then, recruiters turned up who were of quite a different type. Russians, usually recent communist political commissars. White guards didn't accept that type of employment. These recruiters scheduled a meeting in the camp, condemned the Soviet regime, and appealed to prisoners to enlist in spy schools or in Vlasov units. People who have never starved, as our war prisoners did, who have never gnawed on bats that happened to fly into the barracks, who have never had to boil the soles of old shoes, will never understand the irresistible material force exerted by any kind of appeal, any kind of argument whatever, if behind it, on the other side of the camp gates, smoke rises from a field kitchen, and if everyone who signs up is fed a bellyful of kasha right then and there, if only once, just once more before I die. And hovering over the steaming kasha and the inducements of the recruiter was the apparition of freedom and a real life, wherever it might call. To the Vlasov battalions, to the Cossack regiments of Krasnov, to the labor battalions pouring cement in the future Atlantic Wall, to the fjords of Norway, to the sands of Libya. To the Hiwi unit, Hilfsspieliger, volunteers in the German Wehrmacht, there being 12 Hiwi men in each German company. And then, finally, to the village Polizei, who pursued and caught partisans, many of whom the motherland would also renounce. Wherever it might call, any place at all, at least anything, so as not to stay there and die like abandoned cattle. We ourselves, released from every obligation, not merely to his motherland, but to all humanity, the human being whom we drove to gnawing on bats. And those of our boys who agreed to become half-baked spies still had not drawn any drastic conclusions from their abandoned state. They were still, in fact, acting very patriotically. They saw this course as the least difficult means of getting out of POW camp. Almost to a man, they decided that as soon as the Germans sent them across to the Soviet side, they would turn themselves in to the authorities, turn in their equipment and instructions, and join their own benign command in laughing at the stupid Germans. They would then put on their Red Army uniforms and return to fight bravely in their units. And tell me, who, speaking in human terms, could have expected anything else? How could it have been any other way? These were straightforward, sincere men. I saw many of them.
They had honest, round faces and spoke with an attractive Vyatka or Vladimir accent. They boldly joined up as spies, even though they'd had only 4 or 5 grades of rural school and were not even competent to cope with map and compass. It appears that they picked the only way out they could, and one would suppose that the whole thing was an expensive and stupid game on the part of the German command. But no, Hitler played in rhythm and in tune with his brother dictator. Spy mania was one of the fundamental aspects of Stalin's insanity. It seemed to Stalin that the country was swarming with spies. All the Chinese who lived in the Soviet Far East were convicted as spies, Article 58-6, and were taken to the northern camps, where they perished. The same fate had awaited Chinese participants in the Soviet Civil War, if they hadn't cleared out in time. Several 100,000 Koreans were exiled to Kazakhstan, all similarly accused of spying. All Soviet citizens who at one time or another had lived abroad, who at one time or another had hung around in tourist hotels, who at one time or another happened to be photographed next to a foreigner, or who had themselves photographed a city building, the Golden Gate in Vladimir, were accused of the same crime. Those who stared too long at railroad tracks, at a highway bridge, at a factory chimney, were similarly charged. All the numerous foreign communists stranded in the Soviet Union, all the big and little Comintern officials and employees, one after another, without any individual distinctions, were charged, first of all, with espionage. Iosip Tito just barely escaped this fate, and Popov and Tanev, fellow defendants of Dimitrov in the Leipzig trial, both got prison terms. For Dimitrov himself, Stalin prepared another fate. And the Latvian riflemen, whose bayonets were the most reliable in the first years of the revolution, were also accused of espionage when they were arrested to a man in 1937. Stalin seemed somehow to have twisted around and maximized the famous declaration of that coquette, Catherine the Great. He would rather that 999 innocent men should rot than miss one genuine spy. Given all this, how could one believe and trust Russian soldiers who had really been in the hands of the German intelligence service? And how it eased the burden for the MGB executioners when thousands of soldiers pouring in from Europe did not even try to conceal that they had voluntarily enlisted as spies? What an astonishing confirmation of the predictions of the wisest of the wise. Come on, keep coming, you silly fools. The article and the retribution have long since been waiting for you. But it is appropriate to ask one thing more. There still were prisoners of war who did not accept recruiting offers, who never worked for the Germans at their profession or trade, and who were not camp police, who spent the whole war in POW camps without sticking their noses outside, and who, in spite of everything, did not die, however unlikely this was. For example, they made cigarette lighters out of scrap metal, like the electrical engineers Nikolai Andreevich Semyonov and Fyodor Fyodorovich Karpov, and in that way managed to get enough to eat. And did the motherland forgive them for surrendering? No, it did not forgive them. I met both Semyonov and Karpov in the Butyrki after they had already received their lawful sentence. And what was it? The alert reader already knows. 10 years of imprisonment and 5 muzzled. As brilliant engineers, they had rejected German offers to work at their profession. In 1941, Junior Lieutenant Semyonov had gone to the front as a volunteer. In 1942, he still didn't have a revolver. Instead, he had an empty holster, and the interrogator could not understand why he hadn't shot himself with his holster. He had escaped from captivity 3 times, and in 1945, after he had been liberated from a concentration camp, seated atop a tank as a member of a penalty unit of tank-borne infantry, he took part in the capture of Berlin and received the Order of the Red Star. Yet, after all that, he was finally imprisoned and sentenced. All of this mirrored our nemesis. Very few of the war prisoners returned across the Soviet border as free men, and if one happened to get through by accident because of the prevailing chaos, he was seized later on, even as late as 1946 or 1947. Some were arrested at assembly points in Germany. Others weren't arrested openly right away, but were transported from the border in freight cars under convoy to one of the numerous identification and screening camps, PFLs, scattered throughout the country. These camps differed in no way from the common run of corrective labor camps, ITLs, except that their prisoners had not yet been sentenced, but would be sentenced there. All these PFLs were also attached to some kind of factory or mine or construction project, and the former POWs, looking out on the motherland newly restored to them through the same barbed wire through which they had seen Germany, could begin work from their first day on a 10-hour workday. Those under suspicion were questioned during their rest periods, in the evenings and at night, and there were large numbers of security officers and interrogators in the PFLs for this purpose. As always, the interrogation began with the hypothesis that you were obviously guilty, and you, without going outside the barbed wire, had to prove that you were not guilty. Your only available means to this end was to rely on witnesses who were exactly the same kind of POWs as you. Obviously, they might not have turned up in your own